Welcome to Leave Your Mark, where I explore the influences that have shaped the lives of our incredible guests. These are the stories of lives worth talking about. Follow me on Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Pain, or link up with me on my Facebook fan page at Scott G. Livingston. My goal is to create a community of people who take every opportunity to live high-performing lives. Before I get started on today's podcast, I want to take a moment to connect you with my sponsor, ReconditioningHQ.com. Reconditioning is a method and language of integrated practice. It brings the worlds of therapy and conditioning together and helps them become more powerful and more practical. If you live in one or both of these worlds, or you use the services of a therapist or conditioning coach, you know that sometimes they don't see eye to eye. They aren't on the same page. Reconditioning provides a time-tested process for aligning these two worlds and creating impactful solutions to performance problems. Follow them at Reconditioning HQ on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or become a member of their Facebook group, Reconditioning HQ Revolution, and join the Reconditioning Revolution. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a legendary podcast conversation on performance with a group of, I would say, legendary characters in hockey and strength conditioning and performance. Around the room, we've got Stephen Norris, Mark Fitzgerald, Mike Boyle, Matt Price, Mike Potenza, Lauren Goldberg, and we are awaiting Matt Nickel, who just admitted himself. So, okay, we've got the big guy in the house. So as we come on here, you're a little late to the party. Cha-ching, as we like to say in hockey, Nickel. They can't hear me yet. So you get the cha-ching for being late to the party, like the bus, like in the bus in the old days.
You can take it out of my contract.
I pulled a Matt Nickel and walked away for a sec. I apologize.
Nice. So we've gotten started here. Nice to everybody. I was just introducing everybody. Good to see you, Matt Nickel, as well. So we've got a great group of guys from a really eclectic history in hockey. And thanks for taking the time today, guys. I think we'll have a lot of fun with this conversation. I want to start. I'm going to go to the two old guys in the room just for some perspective. Maybe start with Mike and then Lauren. When you look back at when you guys started in the business and you look at what hockey was then and what it is now, what stands out most to you? What do you kind of look back at and go, holy geez, I can't believe what the game has become now. So maybe Mike and then Lauren, give me your thoughts.
I think probably more than anything that the size of the players. I can remember talking to Michael Connell years ago when he was the GM of the Bruins and talking about guys being, you know, there's going to be guys 6'6", 6'8", and 260 pounds, you know, because they were talking about guys losing weight and, you know, we need this guy to get lighter. And I'm like, you don't see where this is going. These guys, you know, and I say to people now, if I told you that the, you know, the Char would win a Norris Trophy and that he'd be whatever he is, you know, 6'8" or 6'7" and 200, and, you know, the legend in Boston, he's probably 350 pounds, but, you know, he's probably legitimately 260 pounds. And I mean, it's the change and then the swing of the pendulum, because now we're back, there's smaller guys playing again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've almost seen it, you know, go way, way up and then come back kind of down to earth. I mean, there was a time when I remember Cam Neely was big and they just had an article on him in the paper. He was 6'1", 215, and he was a freaking monster, you know, killing people. I saw Rick Tocchet one day live now, and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe how small he is. You know what I mean? Like, these were guys that I thought like were big, tough guys. And now you look at them and think they'd be really, really average size wise anyway.
Yeah. Lauren, your thoughts?
Well, it's funny, like I've seen changes in guys from a size perspective, but I remember when my first job when I got on with the St. Louis Blues, it was really all about money. When I first started talking about Jacques Martin, and I'm saying money with regard to injuries and the potential for injury prevention, because my very first call was surrounded by the fact that the Blues had over 700 man games lost to injury that year. You know, Jacques was a phys ed guy from St. Lawrence. They had no kind of program whatsoever in St. Louis. And they felt that, you know, if they were doing something fitness wise, it might have an impact on their budget, if you will. And back then, God, like, so there were 700 games. I think the average salary per game was about $1,000. And I think the Blues payroll back then was $3.8 million, give or take. So, you know, and the Blues weren't drawing like they kind of do today or were having the success that they had. So it had a lot to do with, you know, what could we do to try and keep the guys healthier over a longer term, and then you know, the benefits of strength and conditioning would just be like a bonus. But if we could knock down how much they're paying in man games lost to injury, it would be a big thing. And then, you know, the other interesting thing about that was I found, like, when I first started, there were a lot of guys that, you know, were not happy to see me come in and start working with the team. Like, it was just something else that they had to do. And guys were almost secretive also back in the day, right? So they didn't want me around because it was going to be more work. But then you could tell who the guys were who wanted to impress the coaching staff with whatever physical abilities they had. And then there were the guys that didn't want to. And one that kind of stuck out for me was Brian Sutter, who was a captain of St. Louis Blues back in the day. And, you know, he was like an old farm guy from the Sutter family. And he, you know, he probably just, you know, worked out on his cattle farm in the summer. And I remember I got brought in at the end of a playoff series. And one of the tests we were doing were dips. How many dips can you do? You know, just for an upper body strength test. And he ended up doing, I think, 20 dips. And he was, you know, bitching and complaining about it. Like, what does this have to do with hockey? And then he came back in September. And then he did 40 dips in his test. So he clearly did something to get better, or he held back in the postseason testing. So, you know, attitudes and reasons for, you know, guys like us have certainly evolved over the last 30 years.
That's awesome. I remember a story that shocked me at one point when I was working for the Islanders in my first year in the league. The Islanders traded for Craig Janney, and Mike would know Craig very well. And I'll always remember this because he came up to the PR guy and he said to the PR guy, because everybody was legally in the rules, you had to go and have a conversation. If you were called by the television to do your interview, and in between periods, you had to go. So he goes to the PR guy. He goes, I don't do those in between interviews. And the guy says, what do you mean you don't do them? You have to do them. He goes, I don't do them. He goes, because I'm so out of breath, I can't fucking do it. So he wouldn't do it. And then I asked Craig one time how many push-ups he could do. He couldn't do 10 push-ups. And I'm like, Jesus, what happened? This guy's like one of the great assist players and stuff over the years. So even in, this was in 98, like the game had sort of, was still in this sort of metamorphosis. And, you know, when you look back, Steve Norris, at your involvement in hockey over the years as a physiologist, you know, it was the physiologists kind of were the precursor of the strength coaches in the NHL. You had the Howie Wengers and all these kinds of guys who were kind of implicating themselves early when VO2 max was the problem, because we got spanked by the Russians and we had a poor VO2 max. So comment on that a little bit, where, you know, where that shifted and how that actually shaped hockey for quite a while.
We can't grow this podcast without you, the listener, or the support of our amazing sponsors. This year, we are pleased to announce the support of Matrix Fitness, one of the largest commercial fitness brands in the world and one of the fastest growing in the industry. Matrix Fitness produces training tools that focus on improving the training experience for athletes and coaches alike. With equipment that focuses on building speed, power, and explosive performance in the most efficient manner, Matrix has partnered with some of the top sporting organizations in the world. As a global brand with local support, the Matrix Performance team assists their customers with solutions, research, and training protocols so coaches can focus on what they do best, help athletes prepare for competition and getting better. For more information, please request their sports performance package from their Canadian Director of Education, Annie.Villeneuve at matrixfitness.com, and mention the Leave Your Mark podcast to qualify for your 20% discount.
I mean, it's an interesting conundrum at times where sports science in general, I think, classically overpromises and underdelivers in many areas, and particularly when it comes from a purely academic point of view rather than actually looking at what is the solution or what are you actually trying to achieve at any one moment in time or some standpoint in the future. And so I think the early days were looking at it from a general physicality, if you like, if there's such a word as that, and looking at the smorgasbord of components that can actually come into contributing towards human performance. And then on top of that, with the classic sort of time motion analysis of the game, started to see that hockey is not a game that is designed by exercise physiologists. You wouldn't want to do very high intensity repeats and then come and sit on a bench for a couple of minutes before you do the next one. That's not necessarily the way to deal with the intensity of the game. So I think there were a number of conundrums coming in. The sort of pivot point for many physiologists has always been the concept of maximal aerobic power, VO2 max. But I think increasingly, as people really started to see the intermittent nature of the game, that there started to become a little bit more understanding of certainly the base components of playing high-intensity interval team sports, but then really work with the more specific elements. And then, as Mike really pointed out, how the game has morphed over the last, certainly the last 10 to 15 years, where initially it was almost a pastime back in the day. The classic guys would play themselves into fitness by playing the game in the early part of the exhibition period and in the early part of the season, and basically got themselves into shape by Christmas, so to speak. And then from there, we saw a little bit more of a professionalization of the game, and I'm using the word professionalization in the best interest in way, so that people were preparing to be entertainers in the game of hockey, preparing to be their best. And that shifted mentality towards what needed to be done in the classic off-season, and then some attention paid to what was done in-season. And then from there, we've seen the game go through that size is the essential element, through to gradually now looking back to mobility, which has repercussions for everyone that plays the game, really being a very agile, fast type of player. And so we've seen the sports science sort of coming along as those elements have actually changed. And of course, it's pretty classic that the sports science at times may push a particular sport in a certain direction, but tends to react to actually what's going on and what are the trends been. And we see a lot more sort of analysis of the game going on. There are some dangers in that, obviously. Need to look at the right type of information rather than just all the information. And then we've seen from there, if you like, into the more modern era, and I'll say the last sort of 5 to 8 years, where we really have seen, I think, a much greater understanding of the game from everyone involved. People making comments across a whole number of different areas, and the intermingling between the biomechanics and the physiology, and then wrapping it all up in psychological platforms. So for me, I think it's been an evolution of what's happened. VO2 max was a linchpin. It is still underpins all human performance to some degree. The key issue is how relevant it ultimately is as a marker for various endeavors. And ultimately for hockey, it provides a line in the sand, but not to the same degree as if you're going to say run a marathon, for example, or play soccer at the highest level. So there's a sort of modulation of these components. And I think people have started to really realize what are the limiting factors in hockey and have moved into other areas, particularly the ability to actually execute and withstand high intensity repeats.
I'm interested in some of the influencing factors, and I kind of throw this out to the group or whoever wants to comment around, like, do you guys think that the key influencers of the change in the athlete, the change in the game, have come from the rules changes over time and collective bargaining changes and things like that? Or have they come from the implication of guys like ourselves in the league and the influences that we have driven? Or is it a hybrid of both in some sense? Anybody want to jump on that at all? Or?
Well, Michael? Before we go too far, I just, because the VO2 max thing, I think, is the conversation. So can we go back one step?
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the things, and I'm going to have a hard time at some point. You may just want to type in "shut up" because I have a really hard time.
Mike, I remember a conversation you and I had at an NSCA conference way back when with the hockey strength coaches. So yeah. Go for it.
Eventually, I stopped going, but But what we realize, and it's funny because you said like the Howie Wangers of the world, and Steve, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were part of that group. I really like you, but I think I like you less now than I did before. Knowing you,
I didn't mean to throw Steve into that group. I just meant to say, collectively, the guys on this panel,
we've spent our entire careers trying to undo that one singular moment. In my presentation, I found the old Physician in Sports Medicine article, and Steve will remember it, called Pro Hockey Turns to Fitness for a Winning Edge. It was 1984. And we've been trying to undo that now. So what are we at? 25 years, something like that. We've been trying, or 35 years, to undo this VO2 max emphasis that people put in there. Because you'd still get coaches coming in and wanting some type of, aerobic system evaluation. And the only reason I bring it up is, when I was first starting to work at BU, one of the things we did is we did a mile and a half run, because that was whatever, like kind of standard fitness test. And I had five guys that were locked to make the US Olympic team in 92. And we had 25 players, and those five guys finished 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, something like that. They were the last five guys. We did vertical jump and 10-yard dashes. They were the first five guys. And I sat there at that moment and said, okay, I can do one of two things here, which do what everyone's telling me to do, which is train my best players to be like my worst players, or make an unpopular decision and train my worst players to be like my best players. And I think, like, for me, that was like this seminal moment. I looked at it and said, wait a second, I want these guys to have 30-inch vertical jumps. I want them to be able to run a fast 10-yard dash. I don't really care how good they are in the mile and a half, because obviously our best players aren't very good at this. And that was I think for me, that was a really big kind of difference making moment in everything that we did going forward. Mm. Sorry, I just couldn't leave that up.
That's the point of the whole conversation. To pivot off of that a little bit, Maddie, I know when you came into the Toronto organization, Toronto really was one of the latecomers of having a full-time strength conditioning coach. Did you have to broker that? Did you have to manage that sort of belief system and VO2 max and stuff and instigate a different viewpoint? Or how was that transition for you as you came into the league?
Yeah, I was very, very lucky, very fortunate, because I think that I wasn't replacing anybody else. They really didn't have a program in place. So I think that can be a good or a bad thing. I think there's a lot of negatives about that. There's a lot of habits you had to instill and enforce, but I think you also weren't replacing an existing regime or a dogma that had been put in place by anybody else. But probably the biggest thing is that it wasn't a job that I had applied for, and it was a job that the players had. It was a job that the players had made a move for and requested, and I think that had a huge part to do with it. And we had, several of you would know some of those guys on the team, and Lauren, had worked with some of those guys. We had probably, I want to say, maybe seven or eight guys on the team my first year that either had been a captain of another team or left our team and were a captain somewhere else immediately after that. And all of them were, maybe not exactly, everyone has different philosophies about what constituted, strength and conditioning and fitness, whatever. But for the most part, they all believed in that. We didn't have, we had one or two guys that were a little bit, maybe old school or didn't buy in completely. But we had such an unbelievable buy-in from the players. They just wanted direction. So it was actually pretty easy for me to get the message across. And I think I came in at a good time because they were just coming off of a couple of years of having, exceptionally high man games lost. They went through a playoff run where almost all their best players were out of the playoffs due to injuries. So I think it was great timing for me. They were receptive to some new ideas. So I think I was very lucky that way.
That's awesome. I want to get Mark and Mike and Matt into this in a way, because you guys have kind of experienced the new NHL in some sense and have been a part of that world and the stuff around monitoring and things, and sort of circling back to my question about the influencers, and maybe we'll weave a little bit of that. And I'd like each of you to sort of take a shot at this, but we're getting into, this monitoring world now and all the different factors of what the expectations are of load, and whether that's speed or aerobic stress or anaerobic stress or whatever it is. what do you guys think is the good and the bad of that in, at this point in its metamorphosis? And I'd pitch it out to any one of you to start.
I think the ultimate bad is that you don't know the cost of doing business in a game. Like it's refuted against from the CBA that you can't monitor during games. There's a couple steps being taken where they will be doing that, I think, next year, to know the true cost of a game. And so we can weigh practice loads against that, and everybody can do their own kind of style of monitoring to kind of build their load analysis against. But I think that's a huge problem when you have a league that wants to do it and promote it from a sales standpoint, and then you have a players association who's pushing back against it because they think it's going to be used against them in contract negotiations, right? So I think I can speak for all of our strength coaches in the fact that they want to utilize it to help their athletes, and whether reduce man games lost or get an extra year or two out of somebody's contract or actually helps improve somebody to be more productive. So but that's a tough pill to swallow for us, Scotty. Is you don't know what a game costs. There's been some offline analysis through heart rate monitoring, maybe a couple catapult here and there, but it's not across the board. And you have AHL analysis, you know, minor league games, but that still doesn't compare. You're comparing apples, or you're comparing fruit, but you're not comparing, you know, apples to apples in a way. So
I jump on with that too, Mike, in that, you know, there's such a disconnect between management, players, and staff. You know, like there's just not that I've seen anyway, especially in my experience recently, the disconnect is large. You know, there's the misconception from the management side of what the attributes are and what they mean. And then from the player side, you know, it's a threatening thing. It's a threatening thing. And then you go to the staff and it's, well, why aren't these two sides talking? Like they're like Mike just said, they're not talking about the same things, you know, like there's such a misconception or whatever word you want to use that doesn't connect all those pieces for everyone. That was a big struggling point for me. It's like, well, you go to the players and say, well, if I know what you're doing, then I can help you by adjusting X, Y, and Z. And then you go to the management and go, if we know what type of players we want, then we can start to look and refine our draft selection and our, you know, rating players or whatever that is. Don't you see how those things work together? You know, and it's just, you know, it's almost, you know, my GM would come down to me sometimes and, oh, I saw this on Twitter. Is this good? Are we doing this? You know, I'm just like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, yeah, we're doing that. Okay, good. Yeah. Oh, Jesus. You know, you just shake your head for the rest of the day. And it's like, but those are real conversations that I had. You know, I was talking to my staff yesterday, and when I've had some pretty old school coaches, and, you know, I used to go into the room in the morning, they're like, hey, guys, what are we doing today? You know, everybody started to kind of just wake up a little bit and stretch out and like, yeah, okay. Yeah. What are we going to do today? I'm like, wow, this is the NHL. I got to come in here and kind of kick the tires and wake you guys up. And, you know, and that wasn't always the case, and it got a lot better for sure. But early on was just like, how do we not know what we're doing? Like, how do we not at least have like an overarching plan to speak to intensity, to volume, to blow, you know, whatever, even to just speak to our schedule. I remember my first year, I put together 6-week block schedules of like, here's all our practice times. Here's all our games. Here's all our travel. We have all this information, you know, and here's all my suggestions based off all this stuff. And the coaches would look at it and just go, oh yeah, okay. And I was just like, oh, that took me 4 hours to do that. Like, you're not even going to really like digest it, you know? And that to me was just bananas, you know, like how do you not look at the information in front of you?
Maddie, do you have a final comment in that area, or not a final comment, but I know where I want to spin this next. So go for it.
Well, yeah, I think Puck Batenza and Fitzy kind of hit it on the head there, but I think just to add to that, there's been an amazing rush to adopt technology. And I think, you know, when you talk about the good and the bad of monitoring, there's so much available to strength coaches, to sports scientists, to physiologists, to athletic trainers. There's a lot of technology being kind of stuffed down our throat. And I think there's there's pressure to adopt quickly and to implement. And like Fitzy said, you know, you got people coming to you with tweets about something someone else is doing, and we got to get this and we got to get that. And it's amazing. There's this pressure to adopt, and then you got to start churning out data, which has zero meaning or context. And I think the good and the bad of it is there's really smart guys out there that are taking information. They've started with excellent questions, and they're starting to apply data technology and data collection to it. And they've got some good stuff, but there's a lot of noise and there's a lot of shit out there too. And what's happening, I think, around probably a lot of pro sports right now is probably creating more confusion than we are clarity. And, you know, that's kind of a stumbling block right now. And I don't think it's something that we can't work through. I think, you know, for better or worse, 25 years ago, VO2 max was a common language. We all understood what it meant, GMs, coaches, players. And like I said, whether it was good or bad, you knew what it meant. And I think we're moving slowly towards a new common language, and that might be load. So load right now is a really, you know, it's a buzzword, but it's a real thing. There's a lot of great science on it. And I think we're just in this process of creating a new language. What's relevant, what has meaning, and what can we actually apply to help our players perform better?
Scotty, can I just add something to that?
Yeah, sure, Lauren, for sure.
Just with regard to what Fitzy said, like, that's, you know, it's always disappointing to hear, you know, when a coach or manager is not kind of supporting the good work that you're doing. And I think the ability, whether you've got great technology or whether you've got a really advanced and smart conditioning coach that can add some value to the whole process, like Fitzy was trying to do, it's really a function of your head coach, because your head coach is to me, is the guy who is the gatekeeper of all information kind of coming in and out. He's making the decisions day to day about the team, whether it's a day off, how long the practice is going to be, are we going to travel right after the game? And I was lucky, like Jacques Martin, like I, you know, worked with him pretty well my whole career, and was lucky that he was such an open and forward thinking guy. And we used to, you know, we didn't have technology in 2009 or 2010 with Montreal Canadiens, but him and I used to sit down all the time, and we'd go over, I mean, it's, you work with what you have, right? So we would just look at, you know, minutes played for the players, our travel schedule, our schedule, how it was coming up. And that's how we kind of managed load back in, you know, the, you know, mid 2000s, if you will. And, you know, it wasn't an exact science, but it was a gut feeling. It was based on experience. And we made it work for what we were able to do. And you know, doesn't matter how good your technology is, you know, like all you guys are outstanding coaches and scientists in the area. If your coach is not going to utilize the technology that you have, what's the point?
Yeah, well, I feel like, and that I'd love to hear anybody's viewpoints on this or variable viewpoints on it, but I feel like there's still, and it kind of comes off of what Mark said, but my feeling when I came in the league was that a lot of people were engaging strength coaches because it was kind of like the fad of we needed to have somebody. So we need to have a strength coach, so we're going to have one. Now we have assistant strength coaches, and we have monitoring systems, and we have analytics guys, and we have all this stuff. But everybody seems to be getting it because they need to get it versus actually connecting the dot between what the coaches need, want, and are interested in understanding, mm-hmm. and what all of us science-based professionals bring to the table. And I'm confounded as to why that doesn't seem to continue to change more graphically. And it kind of brings me back to that question of what the influencing factors are on performance change. Have they been more, you know, CBA / you know, fad / money / all these things, or are people actually, like, do people actually get it, you know, that the value prop of this stuff is to have, you know, high quality people doing high quality work in their space? Anybody want to jump on that?
I'd like to make one comment. This was a kind of a tough realization that I've come to after a while now, is that I think most of us, you know, not necessarily us on the call, but us in the greater sense, you're either, when you're in this position, you're either working to keep your job or you're working to do your job? And I guess it just depends on your philosophy or your viewpoint of, do you have a philosophy, or are you passionate about one specific stance that's the hill that you're willing to die on, and you're not going to bend or break? And I find that now that my work life has transitioned a little bit, I'm doing more consulting with teams. Lauren is 100% correct. That's all that really matters at the end of the day. It's what the head coach wants. And I think everyone on this call, and I would imagine a lot of people that are listening, are very passionate about what they do. We take our job, our profession, as seriously as any head coach takes theirs. And some of us would probably make an argument that we take it more seriously. I don't know how many coaches, I'm sure a lot are, but I don't know how many are continually going to, you know, to do continuing education. I don't know how many other NHL coaches are jumping on a Zoom call with their peers like we are today. So I certainly think we're as passionate about what we do. But at the end of the day, I found with my, you know, in a consulting role now, not being the guy day to day in the gym, but kind of dropping in on different teams here and there, the role of the strength and conditioning coach, whether you like it or don't, and a lot of times I don't like it, but the reality is that role is to support the philosophy of the head coach. Mm. You know, and I can think of, you know, numerous examples, and one in particular, I remember spending time with the Buffalo Bills in 1999 in their training camp, and their strength coach at the time, Rusty Jones, who's a, you know, well-known name in our business. They at one point switched to a no huddle offense. They decided the new coach came in and decided they were going to go with a no huddle offense. Well, all of a sudden now it has a dramatic effect on your strength and conditioning program. It doesn't really matter what your philosophy is anymore. Your job is now to prepare those guys, whether you like it or don't, to prepare them for the offense, in that case, of football that a coach wants to run, or if a hockey team, it's of a style of play. So I know for me personally, it's come at a great cost because I was, you know, I had that hill that I was willing to die on, and I wasn't willing to budge. And I can remember in particular, and actually this is funny because, you know, in my professional situation, I got to a point where I, in agreement with everybody else in the call, in agreement with everything that Mike had said, and Mike Boyle and I had numerous conversations before that about the VO2 max and, you know, how much I disliked it. Everybody came to the point where I had a coach, we were just so philosophically opposed. And I remember getting called into the general manager's office and him, you know, sitting me down to tell me that, you know, this couldn't go on, that the coach and I were on two different pages. And he said that he had reached out to a friend of his, Mike Boyle. And I thought, perfect. This is great. And case closed. He said, yep. I talked to Mike and I asked him everything about it. And Mike agreed with what you said. And I thought, okay, thank God we're done. He said, yeah, but regardless, it doesn't matter. It's, you know, it's the coach's ship to sail, and you either, you know, get it, row in the same direction or get off the boat. So I think that's a lesson that I've had to learn. It's unfortunate. Maybe there'll be a day, you know, in a time where the people on this call or people like us will have an equal say, but I don't think that time is now. I don't see that coming. You know, it's getting a little better, but I think for the time being, you really have to make that choice that is it about your philosophy or is it about, you know, supporting the philosophy of the real decision maker, which is
our sponsor. Reconditioninghq.com is going virtual. The Reconditioning Level 1 has been turned into a complete online experience, and all the time-tested systems and processes are now available to you in 20 hours of online video modules and 2 virtual Zoom sessions. Reconditioning is a very powerful language and system of practice that brings the worlds of therapy and performance together in one complete package and helps you deliver the most powerful injury and performance solutions to your clients. Check them out at reconditioninghq.com today and join the Reconditioning Revolution.
The coach.
Well, I'd like to spin off that back to Mike for a second, because, you know, you made that comment earlier, Mike, about your viewpoint of VO2 max and your decision to sort of stand your ground on what you were going to train your guys to do. What gave you the confidence, A, to do that, and B, to make the decision that you would sort of you know, see where the chips fell versus sort of going with the herd, as one might describe at that point.
Matt might have described it. It might have been what gave you the stupidity to let's not overconfuse confidence and stupidity, but no, but I was like Matt in the sense that I always was thinking, I used to always go, one, I wasn't making enough money where I ever was worried about getting fired. So that was really good. You know, it wasn't like now when you look at, you know, these weren't 6-figure jobs when we started. They were, I mean, I was lucky when we broke, Lauren's eyes just went up, but I was loving it when we broke 5 figures. You know, I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to get a five-figure job for the Bruins. I started out, I think, at $10,000. I'm pretty sure the year that I did it. And so I could be willing to kind of stick my flag in the sand a little bit and say, hey, this is what I believe. And hey, if you don't like it. The other thing I've found is that when you're willing to get fired, you gain a lot of power, surprisingly. And when I was with the Red Sox, I had my first meeting with Ben Cherington, who's a great guy. Now the GM in Pittsburgh, really smart guy, hockey fan. But he said, Mike, what could make us not successful? And I said, you and Bobby Valentine. And he just looked at me and he was like, what? And I was like, you and the manager. I said, I can tell you right now. I said, I'll be successful if you let me. I'll be successful if you support me. I'll be successful if you back up, you know, what I want you to do. I said, or I will fail miserably when you guys start to take the players' sides in these arguments. And I was really lucky. 30 years with Jack Parker at Boston University. He was unbelievable in terms of, okay, what are we going to do? All right, I'll make everybody do it. And, you know, that's, I used to tell people all the time, you pick jobs, not by salary, not by logos, but by head coaches. Who are you going to go work for? If you're going to go work for somebody who you don't have a chance to win with, you're stupid, you know, because you're just getting on a sinking ship. Or in the NHL, you just wait for them to get fired. Because I could probably try to think Rick Bowness, Brian Sutter, Mike Milbury, Pat Burns, oh God, Steve Casper. This was my career in Boston. We went through at least a guy every 2 years. Sometimes we went through two in a year. So sometimes I just realized, this has gone to shit. I'll wait a week and there'll be somebody else in here and they won't have any idea what I'm doing and they won't care because they change coaches so often.
What's in your ZNA? That is a question our sponsor Zenkai Sports has for you. Are you interested in increasing your performance output, helping the environment, and doing less laundry? If you answered yes to any of those questions, please go to ZenkaiSports.com and check out the latest innovation in performance apparel. Zenkai uses cutting-edge technology that repels sweat and other liquids. Zenkai apparel lets the sweat stay on your skin, keeping your cooler for longer and repelling odor-causing bacteria. This means Zenkai apparel can be worn 10, 15, 20 times with no washing required. I would highly recommend trying this amazing product, and I've teamed up with them so you can get 20% off your entire order. Just head over to ZenkaiSports.com and use the discount code LYM20. Well, that's an interesting irony of the business, because based on what Matt just said, which I don't disagree with fundamentally, but when you look at it that way fundamentally, to change the fundamental philosophy of how you train your athletes, prepare your athletes, get your athletes together as an organization, and that changes very quickly based on bringing in a new coach all the time. Just to put it out there for conversation, do you think that that's ridiculous, or that somebody has to examine that? Or, like, to me, that makes no sense. Like, to me, there needs to be a fundamental organizational philosophy of how you prepare your athletes, and then the coach comes in and runs their system based on the athletes. But am I screwed in my belief system? I don't know.
I agree, Scotty. I think it's, again, from what I said before, there's just that disconnect is so large that it's really hard to, you know, connect the dots, and, you know, and that's one of the things that I probably didn't realize at the time when I first went to Anaheim was I want to make an organizational tool here, something that will help us. Yes, we want to win games and, you know, the regular season, do all that stuff. But realistically, I saw my job as more of, okay, how can I implement a strategy across the entire organization that helps us create better players quicker? You know, how can I make a tool or tools that can take a kid that's been drafted and instead of it takes him 3 years to come to our team, it's 2 years. You know, how much more does that help us? How can we create a profiling system of, hey, if we want a, you know, puck moving defenseman, how do we look for that kid? And you know, how do I educate the scouts? How do I educate? But it turned into such a massive job and really one that wasn't really well received. You know, my first year was like, I remember talking to our equipment manager who was in the NHL for like 40 years, Sluggo, some of you guys might even know him. And, you know, we're talking about budgeting and stuff. And he's like, He's like, buddy, ask for whatever you want right now. Don't put a limit on anything you ask for in the first year. I'm like, really? He's like, yep, because you won't get it again. And man, was he right, you know, in terms of just anything really. You know, the first year I could have asked for, whatever I wanted really. And you know, the subsequent years after that, it just started to slowly, we're not going to do that this year. It's like, oh, okay. We're not going to feed the players breakfast. Okay. All right. That's a good idea. Solid plan, you know, and that's, I think, again, it goes back to that, just that disconnect from the big club to the AHL to even just the fact that not a lot of teams get everybody together that is involved in the process with the players, scouts, GMs, coaches, everybody. There's rarely a time where everybody is in the room together and discussing things like sport performance, nutrition, coaching, you know, like, and like you said before, like, are these NHL coaches doing continuing education? I'm going to say a hard no on that one. I say that there's maybe a handful of them that do, you know, stuff like this. I could be wrong, and maybe I am, and no disrespect to the coaches, but the majority of the ones that I've been with, that's the furthest thing. As soon as the season's over, they are fishing and whatever the hell else they do. It's not, I think it lies more on the growth of the coaching side of it, to be honest. And I think there's a change coming for sure, like Matt spoke to, but I think it's a very slow change. And we as strength coaches, physiologists, medical, whatever, have overcome them, have surpassed them on that education side of it. And we're just waiting for them to catch up. And when they do, I think it'll be a lot better, but it's not going to come anytime soon.
I think really quick, sorry to add to Mark, like that coaching change, he is absolutely right. It's coming. I mean, there are guys now that are coaching that I had in my first year 14 years ago. There are guys that I was coaching with at college at the University of Wisconsin that are head coaches now. And they've gone up through the American League system. And those are guys that probably were your best students in a way, always in the gym and different things like that. But they have that mentality. They speak strength coach in a way, you know. So that change in more of the support system is definitely going to be on the horizon, I think. I think Mark's right.
Well, I also want to ask, sort of be the counterpunch here to a degree, and ask everybody, do we really sometimes over-evaluate our necessity in the grand scheme of things? Like, I remember having this conversation with a couple of my friends on different teams, especially ones that have won Stanley Cups. And, you know, quite often the teams that were winning Stanley Cups didn't necessarily have the best performance team, the best medical group, da 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 da. They put together this group of guys and went out and won a Stanley Cup and won another Stanley Cup or whatever. And so it's kind of like, I'll always remember Charlie Huddy saying to me one time, we were in the gym, I was doing this training program, and Huddy looked at me and said, oh, we didn't do that stuff when I was with Edmonton. We won, you know, X number of Stanley Cups, you know. And I kind of said, well, you know, they don't run the same car in the Daytona 500 today that won it back in 75 either. But, you know, fundamentally, like, there's lots of examples where not having the greatest performance team still creates success. So I just put it out to everybody, and I saw Maddie kind of laughing there a little bit on that question. But, you know, what is everybody's, the two Maddies actually, viewpoint on that? Like, do we think we're more important than we are sometimes?
Well, I think you've kind of brought up a really good point here. And, you know, listening to, I like that Potenza and me are the two quiet guys here. We're still employed in the NHL, so we got to be tiptoe here.
This isn't going out, is it?
It's a private. Well, yeah. The head coaches don't do PD anymore, so they're not going to listen to this anyway.
If I get a call from Doug Wilson, Scotty, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Fitzy's got the pistols out this morning. But no, I think you're right, Scotty. It's not a blank canvas for us to come in and paint our Mona Lisa. It's the GM's team. It's the GM's vision. The GM puts a coach in place. And like you've all touched on, the coaches are turning over every couple of years. very different than, say, a sport like the NFL or college football, where the strength coach is moving around with the head coach. We're a lot more aligned with the GM and maybe a larger picture vision. But ultimately, we have to be sensitive to innovation and innovating too quickly and too far. And I think it's that innovator's dilemma. So we have this vision. We come in hot and hard, and we want to you know, reinvent the wheel, and we have this grand vision of what we want to do. And ultimately, where we come short is when it's not received well by either the GM, the players, or the coaches, and we can't figure out why they don't believe in what we're trying to do. And I think the guys who have had success, or the guys who have been around a long time and been able to move the needle, do it a little more incrementally. And I think, you know, like Mike Boyle said, and like Goldie's touched on, there was a time where it didn't matter. You could come in and kind of flip the bird, and you weren't worried about getting the boot. I can tell you that those times have changed, and probably on the backs of the things you guys have done 25 years ago when you were the first guys in the league, it's come a long way. Right. And we keep saying it's moved slowly and it's moving slowly. But if you look back 25 years, you wouldn't recognize what happens now as what did 25 years ago. And Scotty, you saw that when you came in into LA this last year, and you're kind of, you know, eyes open a little bit. It has moved a lot, but it moves very incrementally. It's a glacial pace, and that's okay. But I think sometimes we get a little too frustrated when it doesn't move whole hog overnight. And that's just kind of how I see it.
At the most recent 2019 World Junior Hockey Championships in the Czech Republic, Team Canada's number one goalie was Nico Daws. Nico is a great story. Heading into his NHL draft year, he was not on the Canadian team's radar. In the summer of 2019, Nico trained hard with the support of the great team at Shield Performance in Burlington, Ontario. He built up his body armor and lost 25 pounds. He came to the Guelph Storm camp in the best shape of his life and earned the number one spot for the defending OHL champs, and then earned his spot with Team Canada on one of the hockey world's largest stages. One of the tools used by Nico was the Matrix Fitness S-Force Performance Trainer. The S-Force is a no-impact, weight-bearing training tool that can improve fast-twitch muscle fiber, increase explosive performance, and support many conditioning objectives. Matrix Fitness produces training tools that focus on improving the training experience for athletes and coaches alike. For more information, please request the Matrix Fitness Sports Performance Package from their Canadian Director of Education, Annie.Villeneuve, at matrixfitness.com, and mention the Leave Your Mark podcast to qualify for your 20% discount.
You know what's ironic, guys, is just this whole, I agree with you, Maddie, this whole conversation, and Mike Boyle and Matt Nick will probably agree with me, this exact conversation happened in the late 80s and 1990s at NSCA conferences. Like, it's, you know, we're all bitching and complaining about the same kind of things that we did. They're just, the technology is advanced, and the specialization has certainly changed, in my opinion. I don't know if anybody will disagree with that.
No, I would as...
Sorry, Steve, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Fascinating conversation, because other than the first preamble where we were really talking about the archaic fixation on a particular physiological measure, we've basically been talking about communication, visions for each of the teams, and philosophy was brought up several times, and the misalignment. I mean, it's a classic exercise that just keeps repeating in misalignment of various strata of a particular organization all the way through. And it's, I mean, I take my hat off to all of you in terms of, for the most part, obviously, except for the odd blow up, having the patience to deal with this. And I think it's extremely worrisome for someone like me, who had one foot in academia through my career and have watched the sort of, you know, the students, if you like, come through, or have been able to at times see the likes of Lorne and Mike working on the other side of the continent in these sort of environments, and to see them and all of them not listen to. I mean, I was just down with Matt in LA about a month ago, and to listen to him speak from when he was, you know, really keen driving sort of student coming through the system, and the world was his oyster, so to speak, to now the much more measured approach, but also a little bit of that resignation of what can be achieved, you know. And I'm pleased to see, as I've seen even, that the system, if you like, is gradually changing. But I mean, I since I care, and it sounds weird, I care about all the guys in allied fields working in professional sports. But I hope to God, for your own psychological health and well-being, that you don't, you learn to measure your performance in much more intrinsic ways, because it must be at times a bit soul-destroying dealing with the system. And I hope our conversation can come back so that we can share with everyone listening, as well as ourselves, you know, the type of things that we think are important to play this amazing game and to withstand 70, 80 games a season and all the travel, you know, because it's clearly recognized that the system is not the best it possibly could be. We all know what we probably should do, the level of preparation that should go in, both for the in-season aspect, the immediate postseason, the preparation phases, if you like. We've talked and had a little, I think, aspect around effective monitoring, you know, what's on our dashboard rather than the avalanche of information that we could have at our fingertips. And I just want to come back to the fact that I think the philosophical underpinnings, anyone coming into this type of job needs to absolutely establish that for themselves. What is my philosophy in here? The aspect of which battles you'll go after and which ones you don't, I think, is well taken. I think that's an incredibly strong mentorship piece that anyone listening should understand, that, you know, you're in the trenches, so to speak, and you're in the long game of what you're trying to influence rather than necessarily always the short time. And I'm going to shut up at that point now.
That was amazing. Matt, you had a comment you were going to say.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I've learned them. In my opinion, I feel like we should take our job very seriously, but maybe not ourselves quite so seriously. And I think that I wouldn't want to be a part of a staff. Like, if you're cleaning the toilets for the LA Kings or the San Jose Sharks, you should clean those toilets like it's the most important job in the world, you know, like Van Gogh or Picasso. Like, I love when I see Dana in Pittsburgh coming into a visiting room and making that like it's a home room, and they've got their nameplates up. And I know that our equipment staff, that was the biggest, you know, awakening for me, my first day working in Toronto, having Scotty McKay, who is our assistant equipment guy, sit me down and read me the rules about this is how shit works around here. Like, you don't put that there. This goes over here. When you put their shoes go in front of their locker, they're facing this way. The bag goes here. The glove goes there. Turn it this way. That the pride in their craft, pride in their workmanship, that's absolutely essential. Now that I run a private business, I wouldn't want anyone working for me that didn't take that level of pride in what they do. But at the same time, to Steven's point, you know, you've got to be able to take it in stride and pick your battles and understand that, you know, this, if you want this job now, if you are so philosophically opposed to the general manager, the coach, or the philosophy of the team, you're totally entitled to that opinion, but maybe you should go work elsewhere. That's not what we're doing here. But I would want, and I would expect every single person from the top down in an organization to do their job with so much pride and so much enthusiasm and truly to care about it. I couldn't personally be any other way. And I was faced with a situation exactly like that, where in order for me to do, you know, what I felt was right and be passionate in the way that I did, it wasn't the expectation that the coach and the general manager should change. No, I'm at the bottom of the totem pole. I should change. It was a bitter pill, but I have to change and do something else. And that's okay too. And I think that, we should expect, I would want my sports scientists to be coming at me with every possible conceivable thing that they could measure, and that we would have a professional enough working relationship and a cordial or friendly enough, you know, personal relationship that I could say, okay, thank you for sharing those two things. It's all very interesting. 1 through 7, I don't like, we're not doing that. Number 8 sounds interesting. Let's discuss that. 9 and 10. Absolutely. How do we do that? How do we roll that out? And they may want to argue, but through points 1 through 7, and that's fine too. And I think that that's, I think that's really where it's got to go. And I don't imagine that you're going to have a championship team, or one that is certainly a team that's successful for a long period of time, where you don't predominantly have people like that from top to bottom through the organization that are passionate and do care. But I think those same people are also respectful enough and willing to bend, that you can make it work. And I can think of one story, for example. One of the teams that I consult with, they've had 3 head coaches in the time that I've been there. One of the coaches, I used to spend hours in his office talking about every aspect of the philosophy, whatever. The second coach that was in there, I probably had 3 conversations with him. One of the conversations asked is whether we should have pancakes or French toast on the buffet. Never once asked me a question about physiology, biomechanics, anything. And at the end of the day, when he was asked in a performance review, he thought that guy did a great job. Yeah. How is this employee? Yeah, he's great. He's a great job. He stays out of my way. He doesn't annoy me. I have no interest in anything he has to say, but at the end of the day, it doesn't bother me, and I can do what I got to do. So it's been a learning lesson for me to realize that I can still be passionate about what I do, and it doesn't mean the coach is going to like everything that I want to do or do it the way that I want, and I just have to be willing to accept that or not.
Here again with another word from our sponsor, Zenkai Sports, the new disruptor in the performance apparel world. Zenkai uses a brand new technology that repels liquids, keeping you cooler during intense activity as the sweat evaporates naturally off your skin. This allows athletes to regulate body temperature easier and push themselves harder as we harness the power of our sweat. Sweat is our friend. Keep it on you. Zenkai Sports is also the only performance apparel company which is cotton-based. All of their gear is over 65% cotton, and some pieces over 95%. Cotton is biodegradable, feels great against our skin, and is much better for our environment than synthetic-based apparel. Please go to ZenkaiSports.com for more information, and for 20% off your entire order, just use the discount code LYM20.
I think, there's been a lot of really good things, in my time. I almost was in that transitional period of I still had guys my first year who were coming into camp out of shape, and it was still, I was more of a dentist and pulling teeth to get guys to work out and things like that. I don't have a problem with the players now, we have grown so much, I think, as a strength coach's profession within the league, that the foundation that you guys set 20 years ago, was tremendous. And I don't think it was just, that position was a nice to have. I think it grew so much in its effectiveness now that it's a need to have. And just only 5 years ago were teams hiring a full-time minor league strength coach. And prior to that, it was all part-time guys pretty much. And then prior to 5 years ago, there was no assistants. So everybody knows all the hats you have to wear. But now that there's more support organizationally for an assistant, for maybe a data person, for a sports nutritionist, you're still wearing maybe a lot of hats, or you're managing a lot of hats, but there's more of a shared responsibility that you have a staff now, which I think is critical, right? Because you have minor league, you have prospects to stay in touch with, but team, but it definitely has grown. There's a small pension. We're in these conversations now in the league about what the strength coaches want to do, what the strength coaches want to track, and I think it's good. It does move slow, and in 5 years, when Scotty, you do a meeting again like this with these same guys, we're going to bitch about something else. But it has grown to where we're going to stay. And the contribution from the private industry, guys with their businesses like Lauren and Maddie and both Maddie's and Mike, and that's contributing to it as well, because the younger players that are coming up are investing into training. And when they get to their leagues, their colleges, their junior teams, they're training. So it's become a mainstay. Not many guys, if you can count them on, even on one hand, who come into camp out of shape, if you will, they're gone. We've sent guys home, that have come in out of shape, or they're they're at fat camp or whatever. They're not on the ice until they get into shape per se. So
I want to pivot off of that and what Steve said earlier I'd like to get Matt and Mark and yourself, Mike's viewpoint, and then come back out to the guys who are working more privately now. But what do you guys see as the still the deficits of the hockey athlete that come to your camps now, comparatively speaking to what the deficits probably were 20 years ago? Like, where can they still, where can the performance coach out there still find space to improve the hockey player that plays at every level, but you know, especially at the highest performing levels?
I'll jump on there. I think from my standpoint, from what I've seen with players coming in, it's just too much hockey. You know, it's too much skating. It's too much time on the ice. It's not enough athletic development. I think everybody would probably agree with that from what they've seen. To, you know, I know it's a big statement, but you know, you get guys that come in that, yeah, they look, they can handle everything on the ice and they can get up and down and whatever, but you get them in the gym and it's just like, oh my God, like, have you ever thrown a ball? Have you ever, like, you know, moved in another way that you're not familiar? Like, how come you can't get this, you know? And I think that was not a frustration point, but it was an interesting point where I looked at that as an opportunity, you know. So we had our development camps, and I remember saying to our skill development guy or our player development guy, like, look, I'm not going to work guys out in development camp. We're going to teach training. We're still going to get some work done. Guys are still going to lift and whatever, but the majority of this time is going to be spent teaching. You know, we've got to teach these guys and teach them about the rep. You know, what does it mean to do a good rep? You know, how long should a rep take? And we, like, baked it down to that, those simple things. And the feedback we got was tremendous, because guys were actually walking out of the experience 4 or 5 days, whatever it was, with, okay, like, I feel good about my program. I feel good about going back to my private coach and having a discussion and talking about the things that I've learned, as opposed to, yeah, I got bagged for 5 days and it's ruined me for 2 weeks. And, you know, it set me back in my program. You know, I found that, you know, when we get them in, we want to send them back, if they're going back somewhere, with a renewed energy, with ideas, with questions for their coaches, as opposed to, you know, it's easy to put people in the tank, right? Like, it's easy to put your thumb on somebody and go, I'm going to smash you until you can't take it anymore. And then I'm going to send you home and you're going to lose 2 weeks of training because of this, you know? And I think that's where, and I know I would probably, everybody on this call would, you know, do something similar in terms of education around actually athletic development and not just more hockey. And that's, I don't know, that's kind of one of the overarching themes that I was, saw a lot of in my time.
Mm-hmm. Did you have something to back off that, Matt or Mike, just because you guys are in the business?
You asked a question earlier. It's like, you know, what's contributed to the change? And, you know, I remember I came in the league in 06 and they just had that work stoppage. And then the CBA came in and they changed the rules. Like, defensemen couldn't clutch and grab. You couldn't enter the zone as a forward, and the D man couldn't just grab you and ride you into the boards. Right. So there was interference, rules changes around that type of play, right, to slow people up. The defensemen had to skate more. And that put more onus on the forwards having to skate faster, right? So I kind of didn't know what that meant back then, but earned quickly, because Jonathan Chu wasn't the best skater. And he had 23 goals on December 5th. And then he finished the season with 59 goals. And Joe Thornton came in December 6th. So there was that. A really good skater was putting up points. And then that was the first year that the rules came in. And then people started to figure it out. Like, you need to be fast. You need to be able to skate. You need to be and Cheech had 40 goals the next year. And then he had 30. And then he was traded and he was with different teams and he was out of the league, right? At the same time, we were seeing players who were unbelievable skaters and they scored 5 goals, 6 goals, maybe 7, at the most 10 a year, but they were getting another contract. They were getting traded and they were getting traded again and they were getting traded again. So this premium that was put on speed, if you will, like we all do anyway, was really giving guys a chance, even though they didn't score goals in the National Hockey League, right? So it was really, I think it was pretty unique, and the fact that I've seen that change, you know, and when you meet with kids and you meet with the development camp kids, they're not strong enough. You know, nobody, some of our players still aren't strong enough, and they think that, okay, well, if I can skate, I'll be fine. Like, the league is still going to have bumping and grinding and battles below the goal line and battles in the corner, and you can't get that by just doing your dumbbell circuit and just skating up and down the ice for conditioning. It's not going to work. You have to be strong and you have to be powerful. And for the style of play that we want to play, you can't escape it, and you have to prepare for it. So I tell our guys, our youngest guys, and even some of our oldest guys, you know, you can never be strong enough. You can't be strong enough. You have to put that premium on into your training, you know, and if somebody else is telling you that, they're either wrong, but they're not giving you, you know, what you need. So
I want to come. I'm gonna let Lauren talk now, then Mike, because I want your guys' viewpoint on this speed animal here, and because I know this is a topic of interest to all in the room.
I just want to kind of back up with what the last two guys said with regard to them playing too much hockey and not being strong enough, not being fast enough, and I'm gonna back it up to kids. Let's say kids from 8 until say 13, 14 years old. And when they're playing in those organizations where it's the perfect time for development, this is where our long-term athletic development model is supposed to come from. There's a struggle between the organizations they play for and their personal needs for athletic development. We have the organization that needs to create revenue streams to have these guys skating all the time, playing in spring camps, you know, playing summer hockey to generate revenue to pay for the rink and for to generate money for the organization. And then there's myself that are trying to get these guys in the gym 3 or 4 times a week, and they're barely getting in twice a week in an off season because they got to go on the ice. It's mind-boggling to me. So it's not just some of the older guys. Like, I've seen even with the pros that I've dealt with, like, some of these guys now are, like, when I first started, guys weren't getting on the ice until mid to late August. Now they're on the ice like mid to late June, which is mind-boggling in of itself, because they don't get on. Nobody's ever forgotten how to skate. That's always been my philosophy. So, you know, it's a widespread problem throughout the hockey world.
Okay, Michael Boy, you've been writing notes for the last 20 minutes, so it's time for you to snap. You're ready to snap, I can see.
Does anybody watch The Voice? Nick Jonas is always writing notes. I'm like, I want to be like Nick Jonas. But, I'm gonna make Steve laugh. Because
you're not as cute as him, though, Mike. There you go.
One thing, we need more orphans. That's what we need. So no parents. If we can find more kids that don't have parents, I think hockey will get significantly better. So, Steve, we need to move to orphanages for our player development and recruitment. But the reality is, one, like Lauren hit the nail on the head, it's become a year-round game for everybody, and that's primarily because of entrepreneurship. We're losing the middle-class and lower-class player. And not so much so in Canada. You still can get the farm kid in Canada, but in the U.S., it's a rich kid sport. It's like lacrosse and crew now, in terms of the middle class kid just doesn't have the opportunity to develop. He can't get on the best teams. He can't, you know, this goes back to sort of, you know, Steve and I have talked about this at numerous USA Hockey things. It goes back to the, you know, the outliers idea and the fact that these kids are getting selected earlier and getting better coaching. And, you know, we've got this early succeeder problem. There's some really good research on early succeeders. And one of the things that you'll notice is that if you look in outliers, they talk about these kids, you know, January, February, March kids being the ones that make the team. The true elites are generally October, November, December. So if you look at like Eichel, Crosby, LeBron James, Larry Bird, you look at a lot of these people, they're actually in the last quarter of the year. So in yearly sports, they were always playing against older people. And so we have innumerable problems that are starting kind of at the youth level. So in my mind, we're going backwards. I think it's worse than it was 10 years ago. It was better. Lauren said the same thing. Our guys start skating, we have to change our programs to accommodate the amount of skating that they're doing. We don't do very much conditioning because our guys are getting 3 hours a week or more on ice starting in late June. So suddenly, you know, we're riding, like we used to not ride the bike all summer because we were worried about guys who rode bikes all year and skated all year and the fact that they were having negative adaptations to that. Now we have to go back to riding bikes because we've got guys who are skating so much that we can't run and skate, you know, otherwise we'd be doing it six times a week. So I think we've, the good thing about this is we've got a whole nother set of problems. And in a lot of ways for us as professionals, that's great because it gives us, if, you know, problems lead to solutions and the people who can figure out the solutions are going to be the ones who do the best kind of in that player development world. But particularly in the US, we have a sociological problem in terms of kind of the economic stratification of this sport, which is going to make things difficult. Even you look at, you know, the rare kid, look at kids like Chooks, they're second generation, you know, Charlestown Medford kids, and they were brought up with money, but they were brought up by a pretty hard nosed guy. But we're not going to have as many of those guys. We get a lot more kids whose dads are, you know, hedge fund guys and, you know, own businesses and own big companies. And these are making it to the elite level because their parents have the money to pay for them to be, you know, to have a shooting coach and a skating coach and to be at every tournament and all these things. So I could rail on about this. It could be an hour Zoom talk in itself, so I'll shut up.
Well, I'm going to leave the last little bit here of conversation to opening up to the group to ask a question to somebody else in the space that you've always wanted to ask a question. I mean, it could be what's your best story. It could be whatever you want it to be. So I'm going to start with Fitzgerald in the corner of my top right. Who do you want to ask? Have you always wanted to ask this question to, but never had a chance to?
Oh man, thanks for putting me on the spot. you know what? I don't know. I don't know if it's a question for one individual, but maybe some comments around. Maybe some comments around the idea of balance, you know, the idea of balance, and which I kind of don't believe in. I like to call it a work-life rhythm, you know, because balancing the jobs that we all kind of have are pretty difficult, in my opinion, anyways. I've become a lot better at it. And I think for me, the last 18 months has actually helped me get better at that. I'm spending more time with my family. I'm, you know, my son's sitting beside me here doing his homework and I'm eating his pancakes as Goldie pointed out. You know, and I didn't miss a hockey game this year of his, you know, and that's something that I'm very proud of. And that wouldn't have happened without what had happened to me, you know? So, and I think Scotty and I talked about this a little bit, but it's the perspective I've gained in the last 18 months has been pretty phenomenal. And, you know, all of you are successful in my eyes, from professional to business side, and you're all people that I respect. So I don't know, maybe just a comment or you know, advice or whatever, however you want to frame it on, you know, that work-life rhythm.
Any old guy want to answer this one?
Or? You want to hear it from a divorce guy?
Lauren, jump in there, buddy.
All I can say is, you know, value your family and your relationships with your wife or your partner or whatever kind of situation you're in. Because I can certainly tell you that, you know, back in the day when I was, you know, working the NHL, I had my own facility in Ottawa. I was working with Gary Roberts in Toronto. I was going around the NSCA conferences and. Without a doubt, I was not home enough, and I don't want to say that I valued it, but I always felt that if I wasn't putting my time in, you know, that might go away. And ironically, it's never gone away. I've had a lot of jobs in my life. Opportunities always seem to come. I've told some of my close friends I think I'm one of the luckiest guys in the world, and because these opportunities keep happening, but. You know, if I had to do it all over again, I might have had a better work-life balance, if you will, because, you know, those things. Like, I've got two amazing kids, and I'm not saying, you know, I should be back with my ex-wife. All I'm saying is you really need to look at yourself and value what you have in your life and not always think that the business should be a big part of it.
Well, you got any comments on that?
I'm an old guy that's still married. So, but I will tell you, same thing. I was very lucky. I quit the Red Sox thing after 2 years. I was making the most money I'd ever made in my life by a long shot, but it was ruining my family life. And I just was like, you know, one of my favorite quotes is, you know, happiness doesn't lead to success. Or happiness does lead to success. Success doesn't lead to happiness. You know what I mean? When you're being successful, you're not necessarily happy. And it's really easy to be looking at it and thinking, hey, you know, all these great things are happening. But if your home life is lousy, I can remember reading a book called One Word. And in One Word, you know, it said you had to pick a word for the year. And I picked husband. And I said, if I can be a better husband, then I'm going to be a better father. And I'll, you know, then I'll probably be better at everything else. And I realized that was the thing that made the big change for me. I've had a much better 50 to 60 decade probably than I did 40 to 50 decade in a lot of ways. And I think it's because I was able to realize, like 50 said, there is no balance. And in the beginning, if you try to be balanced in the beginning, you'll be poor and unsuccessful. So the young guys have to realize that. But at a certain point in time, you have to know when you're doing it just for you. And when you're doing it for the wrong reasons, and when it's not, you know, it's no longer like, I don't have to worry about providing for my family. We're doing fine, you know, but I do have to worry about providing opportunities, and I do have to worry about being present. And a lot of those things I don't need to, but you can kind of get stuck in that economic roller coaster. You know, I need more money. I need more prestige. I need more fame, as opposed to, in my case, I just want to have more attendance. Lauren and I saw each other a couple of times because I was in Pittsburgh every weekend. I went to Pittsburgh every weekend, didn't go to a Pens game, didn't talk to any of the Pens guys, didn't talk to Sully on the phone a couple of times, but I had no contact. I was at Robert Morris, and I drank beer and watched games and was very happy.
Cool. Matt Price, do you have any questions for this group? You're the one of the younger guns on the thing. I'm sure having all this old age security around the room might be interesting to ask a question.
Well, it is interesting. You know, I think for the most part, everyone here is a father, a husband, or has been at one point or the other. And I think that's a really great question that Fitzy asked, and there was some great insight. And I think where you are in your own career, you know, money came up a few times, and that's relative, I think, to where you are in your career. So, you know, I think when you're in your 50s and you've had a long successful career, not as big a deal. And if you're just starting out and you've got debts and student loans and you're trying to buy a house, much bigger factor in life. So one of the things that I hold important in my current position is, among a few other things, but I want to have an impact, and I want to feel like my work matters. I want to feel like I have a positive influence on our athletes, that I improve or change the philosophy and the thinking of our general managers and our coaches. Curious to some of the guys that have been in both spaces, and that's a lot of you that have worked in the private setting with your businesses and your consulting, and you've been in the team setting. Where do you guys feel that you've had the most impact? Where have those moments been where you've been most impactful?
Anybody want to answer that one?
I would say for me personally, I mean, I've been with a number of NHL teams, and it's you know, you can make an impact. I always feel that I help make an impact with regards to our planning. But to be honest with you, I really felt like, and Matt, you worked with me at the Athletic Conditioning Center in Ottawa. I always felt like I had opportunities to make bigger impacts on players, contribute to player success in privately, because, you know, you could do more. And you remember some of the guys that we had in there, Zach Bogosians and Daniel Alfredsons and, you know, Danny Briere's, like those kind of guys who come to see us when they were in need, and we were able to help them get to where they needed to be. And you always had a real sense of fulfillment and happiness, like seeing those guys make it. I'm sure, you know, Matt Nichol and Fitzy, and I mean, all you guys have worked privately at some point have stories like that. But for me, it was always working in private where I got a lot more fulfillment, if you will.
Matt Nichol, do you have a comment on that at all? Oh, you're muted. Demutified.
I'm new to this Zoom technology. Sorry. Yeah, I would agree with Lauren 100%. I think that, you know, working, like I've had team jobs in the NHL. I've also had team jobs in other leagues. And I know that in the NHL was probably the best, even though it wasn't ideal and I didn't have control over all the variables. And you always feel like you could do more, you could contribute more. You're not being utilized. Actually, you know what, Scott, one of the best quotes ever you told me is like, your last year, we were having a chat in Montreal before the game one day. And I've used this so many times. I love it. You said, I feel like I'm this computer that's loaded up with all this amazing software, but all they want to do is like send emails and go on YouPorn. Like there's all this, like I have all this information I could offer, but you guys just want like, you just want a little piece. So my job is to give you the little piece you want. When you're privately, you've obviously got way more room. I know that. But in the NFL, not every team, obviously, but the little experience that I've had is you're the weightlifting guy. So not only are you not doing everything you could do, if you're the strength guy, you're the weightlifting guy. If you're the therapy guy, you're the tape and ice guy. You're not the, you know, so there's, everyone's got these clearly defined roles. So, and now that I do consulting, it's been really hard for me in that a lot of times I feel like I'm making little to no impact because a lot of times you're not brought in by the strength coach or the therapist, you're being imposed upon them by somebody else. So you walk into the room and at least I feel like having been on the other side of the fence, I can be a little bit more empathetic in that, you know, that when you walk into the room, you're kind of like a seagull. You fly in, you take a shit and then you fly away. And the coach is looking at you like they have to be cordial because their job depends on it, but they don't want you there. They're not interested in anything you have to say. And it's probably whether it's, you know, whatever the reason why, they're probably more inclined to wish that whatever it is you have to say is not true, if you know, because it came from you. So, I think I would agree with Lauren in that capacity, that for the time being, working privately for me gives me that level of satisfaction. I would hope that, you know, and it sounds like in listening to Matt and Mark and Mike, that the landscape is evolving. I think it's obviously getting a lot better, and guys like Matt Price and Mark Fitzgerald and Mike Potenza have way more input, and they're not just sending emails with that computer now. Now they're interested in learning about some of the other software programs. So I think it is getting, it sounds like it's getting better. I would hope that it's getting better, but that's my two cents anyway.
I would just put a little comment in on this one because I had an interesting occurrence probably several months ago. I was asked by the Canadian Olympic Committee to go and talk to their entire staff with an athlete that I worked with that Matt knows well, Eric Gay, and they wanted a coach-athlete relationship and to talk about that relationship. And the funny thing about it was I walked in the room and one of the guys sitting in the audience happened to be one of the PR guys for the Montreal Canadiens back when I worked for the Canadiens. Mm-hmm. And we had this great conversation dynamic with the COC people, lots of great questions about the coach athlete relationship. And Manny came up to me afterwards and shook my hand. And I knew Manny relatively well, but not super well. And he said, you know, Scott, it was great listening to you because what I always noticed about you in the presence of the work that you did was the way you cared about the athletes and you taught them and you impacted them as a human being. So for me, you know, like we can, and it's funny that Matt tells that story about, because it was a frustrating thing, but I think if you get attached too much to the technical side of what it is that you deliver, you're probably always going to be disappointed because nobody's going to pick up the computer and use it the way you would hope it would be used. But I think if you craft the relationships with the athletes and you when they come back to you 20 years later and want to introduce you to their son because they were so impacted by you. I think Mike told that story when I interviewed Mike about, you know, his career and stuff. You know, I remember him talking about, and he's had the opportunity to train a lot of guys' sons and things like that afterwards. I think that's when you see the true impact that you leave with the athletes that you work with.
And you know what, Scotty, I'll jump in one more thing. You talk about that impact, and I tell my staff, you know, like this is a customer service business on the private side. And I think the team side is a kind of a similar role. You know, you're setting the groundwork for culture. You're setting the groundwork for, you know, behavior to some degree. You're setting the groundwork for, presence and all those things, right, that everybody has kind of touched on. And I know for me, the private side is so much more rewarding on the private side, not so much more, but I find it more rewarding just with because, and I think everybody on the private side would probably agree, is that the guys are coming to you, or the athletes are coming to you, because they want to come to you the majority of the time. Whereas in the team side, it's a little more forced, you know, like, hey, this is our strength coach. You're part of the team. You know, you have to kind of listen to him, you know, and obviously you can manage that relationship as well. And it doesn't always have to be transactional like that. But on the private side, it's, you know, they want to come back. They, you know, I strive to be one of those first phone numbers that guys call when stuff goes wrong or when stuff goes really right. You know, like that's the role model or the mentor, whatever you want to name that. That's what I like to strive to be to that athlete, you know. And I've had guys in my gym that have started their NHL career, finished it, and still train in the gym. Like, that's something I'm proud of. I have guys that wouldn't have careers if they didn't really dive into training and change the way they played and all those sorts of things. Guys you never even heard of, you know, and like, I'm proud of that, you know. And I think that's, you know, we've had 3 weddings from our gym now, which is really cool. You know, people who have met in the gym, gotten married, and, you know, amazing having kids now and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's, you spoke to the human side of it. Like, that is ultimately where I get the tingles on the back of my neck, is interactions like that, as opposed to sets and reps and games won or lost or whatever. And I think that's more cultured in the private side, or more, you know, you slow cook that over time with relationships and what have you.
Awesome.
Scotty, can I jump in there?
Yeah, Mike, go for it, Mike.
Matt, the one thing I would tell you, one is read Inside Out Coaching if you haven't. And, you know, Joe Ehrman talks about what he calls the 20-year window. And when, like, Scotty kind of hit it on the head, I look at this and I think I'm here with 4 guys or 3 guys who I've known for a really long time, for more than 20 years, doing this call. One of my guys, Mike, is on the call. Like, Mike's in the legend panel, you know, and I look at that and think that's pretty cool, because, you know, it's like Lauren was saying, you worked with him. And, you know, guys like Fitzy and Matt, I know, because they used to come visit when they would be in town. So I know everybody that's here. And so I think when you realize, you know, impact, the bad part about impact is Joe Ehrman talks about the 20-year window. You don't get to look through the 20-year window until it's 20 years. And you don't get to look back. And I'm going to try to share my screen and see if this will work. But let's see what happens here. Yeah, this should work. You guys should see this when I hit share. But that's basically Jimmy Vesey's son, Ray Bourque's kids, Bobby Carpenter's kids, Joe Sacco's kid, Sean McGeckren's kid. I'm trying to think who else is in this picture. I'm sliding them over. Tommy Fitz's kids. These are all I had this year alone. I think I had 20-something second-generation kids whose fathers I coached, just as NHL players, not people. We have third, you know, Fitzy's talking about weddings. I have a third-generation family. I have 2 who I've had. I have had grandfather, daughter, and children training at our facility. So the cool thing about impact is it's going to sneak up on you. And you'll, at some point, you'll look at it and be like, wow, I did some really good shit when I was working. But for you as a young guy, you know what you measure it by? Someone told me, number of weddings you get invited to, Matt. When guys, seriously, right? When guys want you to be there with them on the day that they get married, that's a really big compliment. I can look again at a lot of those kids who were in that picture. I was at their parents' weddings too. And, you know, I was probably out on dates with them and their parents. And so you're having an impact, trust me. And somewhere down the line, I hope I'm still alive, probably 15 years from now or 10 years from now, when you get to look through that 20-year window and, you know, you're able to come back and be like, oh my God, Mike, the view was ridiculous. Like, it was crazy. Because I look at it now and think I think ex-clients, 2 presidents, you know, the team presidents, not United States presidents, but a couple of GMs, 3 head coaches, a decent number, a bunch of assistant coaches. People always say to me, oh, you must know a lot of guys in the NHL. I'm like, I don't know very many players anymore. I've said, but I know a lot of coaches and I know a lot of management people, because, like you said, they're the guys that came through. They were my early guys. So I think that's where you'll really see the impact.
Beautiful. Well, I've chewed up an hour and a half of you guys' time. Could go probably with this group forever, but I don't want to take everybody's days and chew them all up. So you guys have been awesome contributors. Thank you for taking the time. It has been a legendary performance conversation and gone in lots of different directions, as I expected it to. please keep in touch, everybody. Thank you for taking the time, and have a great Easter weekend.
Thanks, Scotty.
Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it. Terrific to see you all.
Good to see everybody. Have a great holiday.
Yeah. All right.
Steve, it's always a pleasure to see that beautiful bald head of yours. Love it.
Good day. Bye-bye. Thanks for joining us today on Leave Your Mark. I hope we've left a mark on you today, and we wish only that you pay it forward by sharing this story, taking the time to rate and comment on this podcast. Please follow us at Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Payne, and become a member of this community at Scott G. Livingston on Facebook. Have a great day. Music by Cedric de Saint-Rome.